Friday, August 2nd, 2019. Welcome to Raging Chicken's Out the Coop podcast. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Each week, I talk to our capital muckraker in chief, Sean Kitchen, about the good, the bad, and the ugly in state and national politics. And today, we got a new platform that we're working with. YouTube officially ended its live hangouts. And we're trying Zoom today. Maybe we're going to do some experiment with some live streaming at some point through YouTube's new app. But in the meantime, we are here. It is yet another summer session, so it'll be shorter than kind of usual. And we'll get you in and out today because we all know that you want to go out there and kind of like play in the fun in the sun as the summer winds down. So in this week's show, we're going to talk a little about the Democratic debates. This week, overall, kind of assessment is Sanders and Warren rocked it on night one, if you ask me. Delaney proving to be the leading edge in the pro-private sector kind of front and the anti-Medicare for all and their anti-progressive things. Harris, I'll say a little bit about her. Leading seems to be, to her own detriment, too hard on some of the Democratic Party consultants, which have basically been responsible for the sinking of the Democratic Party for the past, you know, decades. And we're going to talk about a little about Tim Ryan and some other folks attempting to basically go anti-Medicare for all by shielding themselves with union contracts. And we're going to talk a lot about that because this is one hits close home to me, and I know Sean too as well. As of today, only 8 candidates have qualified for the third Democratic presidential debate in Houston on September 12th and 13th. The candidates now will have to have 130,000 unique donors and at least 2% in the polls. Now, they have to August 28th to actually kind of hit these marks. But right now, only 8, and we shall reveal them shortly. And we look closer to home. Scott Perry, you know, he had a hand-picked town hall, and it turned into a disaster. It's basically like Sharknado comes to Central PA. Perry blamed the fake news and the local indivisible groups for conspiring to make the room look empty when it was actually empty. Kind of like Trump's inaugural. Good old Perry. Abscuff, still without a contract. That's right, no contract, no work. Well, no, we'll keep on going. The good news is, I guess, we don't have a lot of details. Good news is, I guess, that both parties seem to be saying things are going well. We'll see. Negotiations resume on August 8th. And the PA Student Power Network is starting a chapter at Kutztown University's campus this fall. All right. Met with a couple students yesterday and talked a little organizing. And today is kind of a, you know, last call, quote unquote, because we're just going to do one segment today. But in our last call segment, we got basically Trump appointed NASA Chief Administrator Jim Bridenstine basically gets behind the industrialization of low Earth orbit, spearheaded by the increasing commercial use of the International Space Station, which I've talked about before on this podcast. All right, this is just the latest in the kind of the pieces being put in place for an all-out kind of free market fundamentalism of space, which we got to watch out for. Now, there's other space news. My daughter wraps up her week at the Da Vinci Science Center's NASA Space Camp today. So when we got one of the reasons why we keep it short today is because I've got to get out of here and drive up to Allentown and get her to camp. Free Will's got 2 new can releases tomorrow. DDH, Love Letter from the 90s. That's a hazy IPA. And another one, which is Cloudy to the Third. Right? Both of these are collabs, right? The DDH, Love Letter from the 90s is using some cornmeal, from Castle Valley Mill. And the Cloudy to the Third is a collab with Levante Brewing. We'll talk a little bit about that. Remind everybody, tune in to the Rick Smith Show on Free Speech TV this and every Saturday at 7 p.m. Eastern. You can stream the show live at freespeech.org or tune in to the Dish Network, DirecTV, or look at the or go through the Free Speech TV app on Roku. And make sure you download Rick Smith Show's daily podcast wherever you get your podcasts, iTunes, Podbean, wherever. Right now, folks, summer is winding up. It's the dog days of August have officially begun. And now we are going to get really serious about 2020 and the need to kind of bolster what we're doing here at Raging Chicken and progressive media as a whole. If we want a progressive future, we need progressive media. And you can help support Pull No Punches homegrown progressive media today. Become a member of Raging Chicken Press for as little as $5 a month. Simply go to patreon.com/rcpress and choose your membership level. If you're not ready to become a member, no problem. Just go to ragingchickenpress.org, click that big blue donate button in the right sidebar. But you know what? The best way to keep the media in the movement and the movement in the media is to become a member. For as little as $5 a month. Just go to patreon.com/rcpress today. Well, there we have it, Sean. Happy birthday week, I guess, as your birthday week comes to a close.
Yep, it was nice.
Yes, it pretty sucks that Sean is now in the untrustworthy post 30 crowd. As I said, do never trust somebody over 30. There goes Sean, and well, what can you do?
Well, at least my back is feeling good. My body has not broken down yet, so that's good.
There you go.
My body from breaking down.
Yeah, that'd be a good thing. Did you have a decent birthday, though?
Yeah, it was good. I went home to go celebrate with my family over the weekend, and then Wednesday, I decided to go for a hike because that heat wave broke, and it was a lot longer than I expected. The hike was, at least.
Oh, it was like the heat wave?
No, I was not expecting the hike to be 7 miles.
Oh, you were not?
No, I did it without it expecting it to be like 7 miles, and it was 7 miles, and it was nice. It was fun.
So you're like driving around on your birthday, and you're like, oh, look, a trailhead. Let me go and see where it goes.
Well, like, so I did this hike before, previously. Uh-huh. I just knew where the trails were at. I just didn't know, like, how long the trails were. They don't really tell you on the maps how long the trails were. So what I did was went to Pine Grove Furnace, parked by the furnace, and then took the Appalachian Trail all the way up to the top, where Pole Steeple's at, and then over to Pole Steeple, and then down and around.
Nice.
And it was a 7 mile hike.
Nice, man.
I did it in about 2.5 hours. I did it really fast.
I was like, that's a pretty good clip. Yeah.
Yeah. It was a nice time.
Oh, nice, nice. Before you kind of, then you just kind of basically came home and went out and celebrated and spent all night partying, right?
Not really.
Yep, collapsed in my bed and fell asleep from exhaustion.
Yes. I was asleep by like 9 o'clock. I watched the debates on the first night.
Yeah.
And I was like, nah, I'm not dealing with this again on the second night. Especially like, don't want to ruin my birthday.
Yeah. Well, I think you made a good choice. So let's talk about a little about the debates. And I think, again, that was a good way to save your birthday is not watch night two. Before you said you watched the first night. What was what's your takeaways from the first night of debates?
I thought Sanders and Warren were really good, especially responding to the attacks, the baseless attacks from Ryan and Delaney. I feel like that's and Hickenlooper. I feel like that stuff is not going to stick to them at all. And I feel like the attacks were so childish that it makes Warren and Sanders look better. Because they were really just like more like ad hominem attacks without like any substance that would stick to them. I thought that was good. And then I really hated Ryan's anti-union rhetoric around Medicare for All by claiming that it's anti-union to give everyone health care.
Yeah,
the union fought hard for those health care benefits.
Exactly. So we should go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, I was going to say like my whole thing is like I don't know any unions out there that actually enjoy wasting time fighting back healthcare cost increases to their healthcare coverage or cuts to their benefits. Every time there's a negotiating contract, I feel like that Medicare for All would give people the adequate coverage without having, and they would allow, they can negotiate their resources elsewhere.
Well, let me tell you, here's the thing is I think the people that matters to most within unions are the top level of union leadership because they see that's what their value has depended upon. It's that old business unionism service model, right? Not a member activated one.
Yeah. Maybe like unions, like this was a trope against Medicare for All, like 30, 40, 50 years ago that like unions fought for these healthcare benefits and a way to not have Medicare for All was to fight for healthcare benefits with these unions so it keep the members on their toes.
Right. We'll keep that. And also
that was just an illogic from 40, 50 years ago.
But it also shows you the mentality, right, of a particular...
The glacial thinking.
Well, yeah, and a particular segment of the labor movement, in particular the kind of like old guard leadership, right? And again, I'm painting with a broad brush here. So obviously this is not everybody in old guard leadership, but that whole kind of business unionism model, which basically says, well, why would people want to join a union? Well, it's because of what you offer them. Right. It's like because we offer good health, like health benefits. So that's why that's the benefit that they get. It's this really transactional kind of thinking as opposed to organizing for power. Right. Organizing for control over your workspace, organizing for the working class as a whole.
I see at the table representation and stuff like that.
Right. And I can tell you is that healthcare. Right. From a negotiating perspective, right. Healthcare is the biggest whip that management has against workers. Right. Because when you're sitting in there and you want to have, you know, say you want an increase in wages or you want to basically negotiate a part of the contract that would be beneficial for workers. So, for example, in my case, you know, when we want to put class size on the table, we want to talk about kind of lowering class size to make sure that you have more one on one with each student, things like this. The first thing you're, well, that's going to be costly. So we're going to have to take it out of your healthcare benefits. Right. And they know that the healthcare matters. Right. Because people need healthcare and unions generally have better healthcare than kind of your average person out there. Right. Because they negotiate.
Professors are going into their careers in their late 30s, 40s and 50s.
That's exactly.
At a point when they're going to need the healthcare the most.
Exactly. So and you look any industry is like this. Right. And if you go into like, say, if you work in steel, if you work in pipe fitting, if you work in the coal industry. Right. And you have a union contract. Healthcare matters. Right. Because those are jobs where kind of injuries can happen. So if somebody's basically saying, well, listen, we're going to take away your health care or you have to pay more for your health care if you want that increased wage or you want dental insurance or you want vision insurance or you want basically more safety standards on the job. And very often what happens is the message from union leadership, right, especially the old guards folks or even from members themselves are like, oh, I need my health care. So they're willing to take less when it comes to wages. What Tim Ryan and others did in the debate is basically take that, right, which is a true thing that unions and union members have very often accepted lower wages, right, in exchange for good health care. Right. And what Ryan and these others basically are saying is that, well, if you have Medicare for all, right, then unions are going to have union members have lower wages. Right. And maybe equal health care.
And which is while going after the only two candidates who actually spent time on a picket line.
Exactly. Exactly.
This whole entire campaign season. You know, I don't see Buttigieg or any of the, or Tim Ryan or Delaney putting their walking shoes on and going to a picket line. You know, while Warren and Sanders have put out there that they are the two most pro-union candidates out there.
Right.
With their legislative reforms. And like they're the reason why why there's an energy within the labor movement within this election.
Absolutely.
I mean, it goes back to 2016 with Sanders coming in. And, you know, like as we were saying last year, like last week, we saw this with like at the Young Dems conference with the re-energized labor movement within the Democratic Party.
Yep.
And there's only two people responsible for doing that. And those are the two people pushing the most progressive healthcare reform plans out there.
Exactly.
That Tim Ryan and Delaney spent the whole entire night going after.
Well, no, exactly. And it's like, look, it's basically a false flag, right? Because basically it's an argument that doesn't like pass the mustard. Like just to give, for example, let me just put the button this
it's
one
It's a
up.
Straw man or a red –
Right. Straw man, red flag, whatever we're going to talk about. Right?
Red herring,
right? Yeah, I'm messing up all this stuff. But the whole idea, right, is that what will unions have then, right? Well, the only way that it matters if Medicare for all is that those people who are comfortable in like, you know, union leadership positions who are wedded to the service model, they suddenly have to question their own like, you know, value. Right. But from a worker's perspective, from the perspective of people organizing for contracts, if you're basically taking the whip, which is healthcare, out of the hands of management, what is management going to then use, right, in order to try to keep you down? Suddenly you can basically say
you have the upper hand and stuff.
Totally, because you now it's directly about your labor and your working conditions, right? It's not about this other thing that you've been forced to get through this weird system that we have in this country of employer-based healthcare. Suddenly that's off the table. And now you begin organizing for your working conditions. You begin organizing for your kind of the fair pay for the value of your labor, right? And you get to extend and kind of think about what it means to have power in the workplace. That is at the center of where we should be going. And the thing is that what boggles my mind about this is that, well, you've already kind of talked about this, is that what the very people that are arguing that are most there for workers and organizing are the people that are being targeted kind of as the bad folks in here. And I'm telling you right off the bat is that it is the worst argument. My concern is, of course, is that it's going to play well within particular circles, right? That, you know, it's going to be reinforced by certain sectors of the labor movement that are not all on board with things like the Green New Deal, right? Are not all on board with particular policy measures, which are also part of the progressive package.
People that are on board with E-Verify and stuff like that.
Exactly. Exactly. But you know what? Too bad, right? And if there's going to be a split on those scores, then that's what it's going to be. But the real energy in the labor movement, right, is not, right, you know, these sectors that like Tim Ryan and those folks are looking at. The real energy in the labor movement has to do with, you know, you look at the National Nurses United, right? You look at what SEIU has been doing. You look at a whole lot of organizations that have embraced a bottom-up level who are frankly representing the workers who represent America, right? In other words, primarily women of color, people of color, those folks in the service.
Our friend from 668, Steve Catanese, was making this argument over the weekend. Like, I think he was tweeting us out or putting it up on Facebook as this debate was going on, pretty much making the same points. Like, how is this like anti-union? It's like, if I didn't have to negotiate like healthcare issues in the contracts, it would be making my life a whole lot easier. Like, pretty much, like,
absolutely.
And that's just like as a union leader, as like a president, like, yeah, I don't have to fucking deal with this shit.
Like, well, and you think about it like this. If I have healthcare that is not tied to my job, right, guess what? I can love it or leave it, right? I can be in a position of like, no, you want to treat me like shit? Goodbye. Because why should I put up with it? People put up with a lot of crap on their jobs, right? Yeah. And union jobs do too, because of the health insurance. I can tell you right now, I would not still be at my current position if healthcare was off the table. Is like, I made a decision, especially when we were first having kids a while back ago. And I said, look, this is, you know, I mean, one, I wanted to be at a union place. Right. But we were getting hammered. Right. And our working conditions and everything was like that. And with the healthcare was kept in place. And frankly, the healthcare I have is a pretty good healthcare, even though we've seen our costs continue to increase over the years. It's pretty good healthcare. If I had Medicare for All, right, it would have put me and all of my coworkers in such a good bargaining position, because we'd be like, look, you don't want to meet what we're saying in terms of quality educational outcomes? Guess what? Screw you. We're done.
And also, I guess another thing with this debate, how horrible were the moderators?
Oh, my God.
Like asking some of those poignant fucking questions on the face, like blatantly, like poignant and like got you and like baiting people into a fight type questions, like out there. It was just like,
well, and what you saw too, you saw how CNN,
like Jake Tapper, whatever.
Tapper. Like, yep.
Yeah. Like him, he was just, yeah, it was.
Well, and you just saw firsthand how wedded CNN is to the neoliberal order, right? Right at the, right, because that every single question they asked was about the status quo of this kind of neoliberal order. Right. All the kind of basic assumptions about taxation, about like, about universal programs, about all this stuff. No, everything was about like, you do the best that you can do. There's nothing else you can do. There is no alternative. This is the reality. Any attempt to kind of expand our kind of politics, or expand our democracy, and to kind of like move towards kind of universal coverage, universal schooling, universal whatever, they're like, that's pie in the sky. So, I mean, you know, in some ways, CNN, you really showed its cards on that score. And I think it's going to, you know, they've been able to get away with it in the past, right? And in part because they have been in the majority. But now you've got a significant portion of the people who are mobilized for this election, right, are like not on the CNN neoliberal order. There are folks that are more wedded to what we see from
MSNBC
Warren.
Order what's either. That? Neither along the lines of like MSNBC. I mean, like we're coming. You think about like this is the first time kids born after 9/11 will be voting. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't get their news from these channels. A lot of people are
exactly.
Like, I haven't gotten my news from these channels in years. Most of my news comes from the Majority Report and like a few other podcasts.
Yep.
Like, yeah, it's. I mean, it's a small echo chamber, but it's where I can get like legitimate, like actual critiques on stuff too.
Yep. Yeah. And, you know, I think I make it a point to, I mean, I kind of watch or listen to Rachel Maddow Show and Chris Hayes All In on a fairly regular basis. Like in my mind, like that's my mainstream news kind of like outlets where I'm checking the other stuff that I get against it, you know, see what's the narrative that's playing in the kind of the public. Now, again, yes, MSNBC is kind of like more on the liberal end of mainstream news. But I just personally, I cannot stomach CNN, right? It just makes me want to vomit every time I listen to it for more than like, you know, 15 minutes. But, you know, MSNBC and Chris Hayes, you know, all those kind of shows, that's really the kind of the center of the political spectrum, right? Whereas you have, they don't really do the analysis. They're more about crafting narrative that is convenient for those organizations and outlets and the kind of the insiders in the system. So whatever, we shall see. But, you know, so now with those debates in the past, the one thing I do want to say about Kamala Harris is that if you notice, two things happened right at the beginning of night two. It's like, number one, when Kamala Harris comes out on the stage and Joe Biden says, go easy on me, kid. Right. Frankly, personally, I think that was exactly what he wanted to do. And I think it pissed her off to no end. Right. And that was exactly what he was after doing. He was out there doing. But
go 30-30.
Oh, no, it's 30, it's 30-330, right? Biden, do you hear what that was all about?
No, I didn't.
So what it was in the end, right? Because it sounded like initially, like he said he couldn't remember 2020 and he was saying like 30-30. He's like, go to Joe 30-330, right? Like, what the heck's he talking about? What he was supposed to say was like, text Joe to 30-330, right? But whatever. I mean, but yeah, that was hilarious. That was hilarious.
And Buttigieg just bought the domain right away.
Yeah, well, a guy from Syracuse University, like who's working for him, got it. Right? Yeah. Got it right off the board. It shows you what it means to be on top of stuff. But but with Harris, it was a perfect example in my mind of who is behind the scenes in the Harris campaign. Right. And this is where you see lurking the very Democratic Party consultants. Right. That whole apparatus that kind of like led to such catastrophic results in the last couple elections. Right. The folks that are kind of giving out advice that is horrible. Right. So what basically Harris did with Biden is basically try to do a repeat of that showdown from the first one around kind of busing, but not necessarily on that topic, but in terms of how she approached him. So what she ended up doing, right, is like turning and looking at Joe Biden, kind of like looking him in the face and kind of talking about this stuff. Biden, by that point, is kind of weathered for it. He's just going to sit there and kind of smile and kind of like look at her. And especially when it came to healthcare, she was kind of trying to hawk a policy that I believe she's not 100% on board with. They were about talking points and things that they say, quote unquote, play well in the kind of American public, according to these consultants. And it doesn't play well. Right. And I think it worked to her detriment. Now, she came a little bit back a little bit later in the debate. But if you watch the beginning of that debate, say this is what happens when you rely upon consultants to do your messaging and kind of your strategy, as opposed to kind of political operatives and kind of moving from the ground up, but sticking with a message and a platform and a strategy. So it is. And as of right now, so eight candidates. The next debates are going to be held in Houston, and that will be on September 12th and 13th. Only 10 or fewer candidates qualify, it'll only be on one night. And we shall see. I'm actually ready for that. I think we need to put aside the two debate nights. I really hope only 10 people qualify at this point, because I think we need everybody on the stage at this point to really start kind of narrowing the field. But so that's going to be – now the criteria are that the candidates need to have 130,000 unique donors. And they have to register at least 2% in sport in four polls, which have yet to be disclosed, as far as I can tell. They have to August the 28th to do that. So right now, the people who have qualified right currently, right, there's eight people. That's Biden, Booker, Buttigieg, Harris, Klobuchar, O'Rourke. I can't believe O'Rourke is still on there. That really blows my mind. O'Rourke, Sanders, and Warren. Right. So that's
I want Marianne Williamson to get on there.
I do too, actually. Especially since she's your buddy now. So, and you've been converted, and you're buying all our books and listening to all our YouTubes, like TED Talks
and
stuff.
I'm listening to her e-books.
There you go.
All about hiking.
Exactly. Well, you know,
looking for moon crystals.
There you go. Hey, you got to give her some credit, though, man. At least she's like, I think she's actually having a positive voice in the campaign. I really do.
She's batshit crazy, but she has some like really interesting.
I don't think she's batshit crazy. I think she is in a lane which is a non-political lane. She's in kind of like the Oprah lane. You know what I mean? And that's been her world, right? And that's how that's how her discourse is set up. That's how her narratives are set up. And that represents, look, like a good chunk of the American population, right? In terms of the kind of entertainment culture. But the fact is that she's introducing things into the debate that nobody else is, right? So we should see. The other thing I should mention too, as well, on night two, Tulsi Gabbard kind of like hammered Kamala Harris on her kind of criminal justice stuff. I mean, there's been a lot of this that's been floating out there in terms of reporting, but it's really been off the table when it comes to mainstream news coverage. And she just kind of went to town on some of Harris's criminal justice record. Now, some of that.
Go ahead.
I was going to say some of that, I believe, is a bit overblown in terms of how she framed it. Right. This is what you get in some components of the dumb left. Right. The dumb left tends to kind of say like, OK, like this is what's happening in California. You worked as a prosecutor in California at the time. Therefore, you are responsible for the whole of all these things. Right. And I think that's a little bit of an overstated case. Not that she shouldn't be held accountable for being part of that and asking what she did about that stuff. But I think Tulsi Gabbard went a little bit far. But some of the other stuff, you know, was pretty good. So that's interesting. I really hope that Andrew Yang hangs on. I want to see him on the stage one more time. He has passed the 130,000 donations, as has Julian Castro, which I would like to have him on the stage too as well. But they do not have the I guess they have three of the four qualifying
polls. Like has credence within like the alt-right community or alt-right spectrum.
He does, right? Look, Yang is not going to get it. He's not going to get the nomination. Okay. Yang's value, from my perspective, of this discussion and of the debates is that he is the only one who's there who's hammering the stuff about automation and having the thing that basically we have to address the underlying cause that people are basically going to be displaced.
I would also say like his UBI stuff is like more critiques of it is pretty, I don't know.
Is pretty what?
bad. I would say like it's like the libertarians seem to be jumping on the UBI argument. Like,
of course they are. But look, but I would put it in this perspective.
Social insurance program out there.
Right. Look, but I would put it one. I'm on board with UBI. All right. I'm on board with UBI. However, I'm not on board with the way that Yang is talking about UBI or any of the libertarians. They basically want to say $1,000 a month cash payment and then eliminate all social programs. Right. That's the libertarian view of this. Yang leans way too heavily in that direction for my taste. However, this whole idea about introducing that into the discussion as part of this, where people actually are hearing it, is really, really important. Because then we could start. Then that becomes part of the conversation going forward, right? So that's my personal thing. I'm not a Yang ganger, right? I'm not someone who's behind his specific policy. However, I do like him on the stage, right? And plus, I just like his shtick. So it's there. So we'll see. Tom Steyer is still not there, even though he's got all the money in the world. So we shall see. But that's it. Anything else on the debate, Sean?
No.
No. So we'll see for September 12th and 13th. I suspect things are going to be kicking up at that point. Summer's going to be over at that point, and we're going to be back on kind of our full-time schedule once again. Closer to home here, Scott Perry is having an interesting run.
Yeah, so he had a house. He had a town hall this weekend. He picked it. He scheduled it in one of the most in the reddest part of the district in Hummelstown. As soon as the tickets went up online, they were instantly sold out within like less than a half an hour. People were complaining that they couldn't get on. They were waitlisted. The debate, the fire hall where it was at, had like close to 150 seats up, and only 60 people showed. And so people were posting pictures of all the empty seats that everyone dispersed out at the beginning of the town hall. And then by the end of the town hall, I guess Perry has got Perry's people were able to condense everyone towards the front with no empty seats. And they folded up all the chairs and put them on the side of the room.
Oh my God.
To make it look like a full room. And he was calling it fake news and everything else. As you could see the chairs, the empty seats like stacked up against the wall.
That's awesome.
Yes. And at the clock in the back had it like at 7 p.m. when the town hall was over.
That's awesome. So now he said, now he made the claim that the local indivisible groups were responsible for this.
For getting all the tickets and not showing up.
Uh-huh.
When they were the ones who showed up and were screaming the loudest because he hasn't had a town hall in 2 years and that he was trying to block all of them from not seeing him.
Nice.
Yes.
Nice. You got to
love
it.
So, you know, just a couple more, another year or so until we have a new congressman out here.
Well, it does look like this is the first time that he's in serious trouble.
I would not be surprised if Scott Perry doesn't run.
Really?
Yes. I will not be surprised if he drops out and decides not to run.
Really?
Yes.
That'll be interesting. Are there any other contenders?
No, I think
on the Republican side?
No. Like, the other names that would be contenders would be, like, Mike Regan, Republicans, like, who are from the Wagner era that have been flaming out all of a sudden.
Oh, boy. Do you know offhand how long it has been since that district has had a Democratic representative?
Since, like, 1964.
You imagine.
Like, since this part of central Pennsylvania, or since York or Harrisburg, has been, like, 1964.
Wow.
Yeah. I see this flipping. I see Eugene winning this seat pretty easily. I do not see anyone running. I don't see Perry. I would not be surprised if Perry drops out. Because it's just shaping up like he's just going to get swept out. He seemed like the other night was the first night of the 2020 season, like unofficial start of the campaign season. And like, I mean, if that was a trial balloon, it sunk.
Yeah.
Like a lead balloon. Like it just sunk like a brick. So. Yeah.
Well, and it looks like that's the kind of place too, that DePasquale may be in a position to keep that seat for a while.
Yeah,
because especially the way he's positioned himself and the way he's gone after, say, corruption and about transparency and things like this, he has not ran, at least from the way I've seen it, right? And any election as kind of like this kind of like ideological left person, right? He's very much kind of about kind of solid government, kind of like ensuring kind of accountability, and definitely kind of has been extraordinarily helpful in kind of exposing a kind of range of corruption across the state. So it's been really interesting to see, and you know, and he's been active and he's been around the state. So we shall see. So Perry, we can look for Perry possibly dropping out of the race. That'd be freaking awesome. Anything else going on from your neck of the woods?
Not really.
Yeah, we're in summer mode, everybody. So I'll admit it.
Next week, I'll be at PA Young Dem State Convention up in Penn State. So
yeah, next week I'm on vacation. This will be my last hoorah to go see my folks in upstate New York before the onset of the fall semester begins. So because then it just nonstop work after that. All right, so I mentioned at the onset and the introduction that AppScuff is still without a contract. Contract expired on June 30th. According to both the chancellor and AppScuff's statewide president, negotiations are going well, and the chancellor has been saying how happy he is with the collaborative environment he's having with AppScuff. From members' perspective, we don't know a lot. Don't know what's going on in terms of specifics. So we're all kind of in a wait and see. We're going at this blind into the fall so far. For the most part, we shall see where we end up. Fingers crossed that we will have a contract. But my prediction, once again, is that once this contract gets settled, that's when the real challenges are going to face faculty and staff in the state system of higher education. I want to remind everyone one thing that major victory, which the PA Student Power Network was in part responsible for and keeping on the pressure for, has to do that there was a 0% tuition increase this year that was passed by the Board of Governors, the first time in, decades, right? That there has not been a fairly substantial tuition increase. As we've talked about on the show multiple times, that one of the ways that the state system has been operating since the 90s or so has been basically to gradually reduce taxes, reduce state appropriations, and put more on the backs of students and their families. When the state system was founded, about 65% of the cost of tuition was part of the state appropriation, right, that we believed it as a public good. And about 25% was on the back of students and their families. Now it's about 75% of the cost are on the back of students and their families, whereas the state contribution is kind of less than 25%. So Greenstein has basically said that he's basically wanted to put this we cannot do that anymore. And he wants to claim that this victory was all, was all his idea not to raise tuition. But we also know that the PA Student Power Network has been in those meetings, and they were the only community group that was at the Board of Governors meeting talking about the tuition issues. So kudos to them for being part of that fight. My guess is that what is going to gradually start to happen is that we're starting to hear very soon after the semester begins, very soon after we have a new contract, that the financial stuff has to be addressed, and we're going to start to see the reorganization of the state system happen in top speed. So we shall see. Another kind of quick news, I mentioned this since I'm talking about the PA Student Power Network. I met with a couple students yesterday. They will be forming a chapter at Kutztown University campus, which I'm very excited about. So look for updates, for on-the-ground updates from Kutztown University this fall. Kudos to PA Student Power Network. And I know a special shout-out to Meg Weiss, who's a former student of mine. Well, a student of mine, I should say, who is basically winding up her PA Student Power Network fellowship this summer, doing an absolute bang-up job in Lehigh Valley. Kudos to Meg and everybody else, and Jarrett, too, especially, for leading a successful fellowship this year. Thanks, everybody, for all your work. That's been awesome. Oh, cool. Quick notes on space things. Just, check out the links in the show notes about the Jim Bridenstine's basically going out there and starting to saying, yep, we're looking for the industrialization of low Earth orbit. And that's going to be brought about by the increased commercial use of the International Space Station. This is just kind of like one of the pieces of the puzzle, which I've been talking about since I started doing the space news in the podcast, is that, yes, indeed, this is the galactic capitalists, right? That is our next generation of extractivism and, free market fundamentalism is now making it to low Earth orbit. This is going to have wide-ranging consequences moving down, and we'll kind of unpack that more at some other point. And my daughter's finishing out the Da Vinci Science Center's space camp this week. That's been really cool. I give the shout out to Da Vinci Science Center once again. They just put on great summer camps and summer programs. My daughter's absolutely loving it. She's yesterday they built a sundial. They did this kind of cool kind of planetary map thing earlier on in the week. Today, they, outside of Da Vinci Science Center right now, they have like basically it's an old Mack truck, I guess, that is basically has been modified to kind of look like the space shuttle, right? And that's parked out in front of Da Vinci Science Center. This is all, of course, in part as you know, the 50th anniversary of the lunar landing. Today, she is going to be headed to go and check out that little mock space shuttle out in front of the Vinci Science Center. So that'll be cool. Quick notes on beer releases. Free Will tomorrow, both at their Perkasie location and at their Peddler's Village location. They will have DDH Love Letter from the 90s. Versions of Love Letters from the 90s that I've had before were awesome. They surprised the hell out of me. I said, okay, it's going to be another one of these hazy IPAs, but it's really, really solid. So I'm looking forward to checking these out this week. And also the Cloudy to the Third, that is our third power. I don't know how they're actually going to say it. The collab with Levante Brewing, that is also a hazy IPA brewed with oats and milk sugar and hopped using Incognito Citra Mosaic in the Whirlpool with a substantial dry hop consisting of Citra and Euconaut. So anyways, check them out. They will be available in 4-pack cans. The Love Letter from the 90s comes in at 7.2 ABV, and the Cloudy to the Third Power comes in at 6.5% for your summer fun. Anything else going on, Sean? Kind of cool stuff happening?
No, not too much. May go to Pizza Boy sometime this weekend.
Nice. Nice. I still got to, when I get back, when I got to schedule at least one day where I'm going to head out to Harrisburg and kind of do a little meetup. So we got to get that going.
Yeah.
So cool. All right. Well, I'm kind of a little bit under the gun because I got to head off to Allentown to bring my daughter to summer camp. I'm glad we were able to kind of put together at least this little one. I'm hoping that the sound quality is going to be relatively maintained. From right now, from my angle of things, we might actually come out with even better sound quality through Zoom than we had before with the YouTube Hangouts, live Hangouts. But we shall see. Thanks for sticking around with us, folks. So anything else for the good of the order, Sean?
No, that's it.
All right. I know we're a little rushed. I know we're a little summertime. I know we're a little like we got to get out of here, but you know, that's the way the summer goes. All right. So this is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. I want to remind you the way that you can support progressive media, homegrown progressive media, is by becoming a member of Raging Chicken for as little as $5 a month. Simply go to patreon.com/RC Press and become a member today. We'll be off next week. Enjoy the summer. And then we're coming back full throttle, folks.
See ya!